This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran with the Today in Parliament podcast for Thursday the 19th of October, when a minister confirmed that the Serious Fraud Office had been asked to investigate claims that some British banks could be unwittingly linked to a corruption scandal in South Africa.
The Chancellor took immediate action in referring that to the relevant authorities.
Only 14 of the families at Grenfell Tower have new homes. Labour says it isn't good enough.
When ministers make pledges but fail to act, or fail to ensure others act, this simply fuels a wider lack of trust.
And the drug linked to the harm of thousands of children.
This is a continuing scandal. It's not something from the dim and distant past. It continues today.
But first, a number of British banks are likely to be investigated over allegations that they may have unwittingly been used to launder money stolen from the South African state. The Chancellor has asked the Serious Fraud Office and other enforcement agencies to look into allegations raised by the former Cabinet Minister and anti-apartheid campaigner Peter Hain. This morning, the Labour peer thanked Philip Hammond.
We're ensuring that the Financial Conduct Authority, the Serious Fraud Office and the National Crime Agency investigate HSBC, Standard Chartered Banks and also, can I add, Baroda Bank, each of which expert South African whistleblowers have told me must have been conduits for the corrupt proceeds of money stolen from their taxpayers and laundered through Dubai and Hong Kong.
Lord Hain said he'd written to the Chancellor on the 25th of September with 27 names.
Including President Jacob Zuma, 11 members of his family, 11 members of his close friends, the Gupta family, and their five associates, together with 14 entities linked to the Guptas and suspected to have been set up for the purposes of transnationally laundering an estimated £400 million, or 7 billion rand, of their illicit proceeds. Will he ensure that those banks, together with the European banks, about which I've similarly written to Commission President Juncker, track down that laundered money, return it to the South African Treasury, and supply evidence to its officials to enable the prosecution of all those connected with such corruption?
The International Development Minister, Lord Bates, said the UK had some of the toughest anti-money laundering laws in the world.
We realise that London, as the largest financial centre, is a target which can be used for these purposes, but we're determined to root it out. That's the reason why, when we are provided with information, as the noble Lord correctly wrote to the Chancellor setting out that detail, the Chancellor took immediate action in referring that to the relevant authorities to ensure that they can pursue it and that justice is done and seen to be done.
But a Liberal Democrat, Lady Cramer, complained that regulators in the United States had been ahead of the curve of their British counterparts.
Even though it appears that London is part of the core allegations, it's happened before in money laundering, it was so evident in the LIBOR scandal. Will he once again look at the resources available and the enforcement strength that our regulators have? And will he also look again at the whistleblowing laws, which, although improved, are still so weak and career ruinous that the regulator doesn't have access to information that should be getting at a much earlier stage?
The minister didn't agree that the authorities in the UK were behind the curve.
We are very tough on this, but we realise you've got to be vigilant all the time, and therefore when issues are drawn to our attention, we respond very quickly and very appropriately to those.
Labour spokesman Lord Davis didn't think the government had its eye on the ball. He said a number of British banks had significant interests in South Africa.
And it's important now that action is taken to make sure that these banks are clear of this corruption, or if not, that action is taken against them. And I do urge the noble Lord, the Minister, to reinforce what he said today elsewhere. It will not do Britain's reputation any good at all for us to be tardy on this very significant issue.
The Minister agreed.
We're taking this very, very seriously because we realise the consequence of not doing so for the reputation of the City of London and the UK.
An independent or crossbench peer, Lord St John of Bledsoe, who grew up in South Africa, said there was endemic state corruption in the country.
What is Her Majesty's government doing to deal with the broader issue of state capture, a term used to describe the misappropriation of state funds by the power clique?
Lord Bates said a parliamentary inquiry was now underway in South Africa, and there were proposals for a judicial inquiry too.
South Africa itself needs to go through its processes to find out what happened and who is responsible so that action can be taken both domestically and internationally.
President Jacob Zuma and the Gupta family have denied any wrongdoing. You're listening to Today in Parliament with me, Sean Curran. Coming up, ministers are under pressure after losing a Commons vote over changes to the welfare system.
Frankly, the road to tyranny is paved by executives ignoring parliaments.
But before that, it's just over 4 months since Grenfell Tower in West London was gutted by fire, killing as many as 80 people. Now, Labour's shadow housing minister has accused the government of breaking a series of promises made in the aftermath of the tragedy. And many MPs expressed concern about safety standards in other blocks of flats. Mandy Baker reports.
It was on the 14th of June that flames ripped through the 24-storey building in North Kensington. Today, there are more than 200 households from the block looking for new homes. Of those, 14 have moved into permanent accommodation. The Shadow Housing Minister, John Healey, asked an urgent question about what the government was doing in the wake of the fire. He said Theresa May had promised that people would have a new home by early August.
Grenfell survivors have a deep mistrust of those in power who failed to respect social housing residents for so long. And when ministers make pledges but fail to act or fail to ensure others act, this simply fuels a wider lack of trust and confidence. And the buck stops at the top.
The Communities and Local Government Secretary, Sajid Javid, said he was dismayed by that.
I know that the Right Honourable Gentleman cares as deeply about helping the survivors of this terrible tragedy as I do, as the entire government does. I really know that he cares. Therefore, I do say it is a shame to see the Right Honourable Gentleman trying to treat this as some kind of political point-scoring opportunity. It is a real shame.
A Conservative, Bob Blackman, thought the process of rehousing the survivors shouldn't be rushed.
Is it not much more important that those victims have a home that they can call their own? And it's much more important that we do that and take time to do that rather than rushing to push people into homes that they do not want.
The minister agreed. Many MPs were concerned about the safety of other tower blocks. Labour's Clive Betts chairs the Communities and Local Government Committee.
The Secretary of State has talked about extra flexibilities, probably extra borrowing for those councils, but he's ruled out any cash, any money from government to help fund this. Does he recognise that many councils may be in the position where they have to defer or cancel other essential maintenance work on other properties, putting the lives, the health and safety of other residents at risk?
Sajid Javid said that each council's situation was different, so he couldn't give a general answer. Labour's Jack Dromey was more specific with a question about his Erdington constituency.
The West Midlands Fire Service has advised £41 million of works, including the retrofitting of sprinklers. The city, however, is reeling from £700 million of cuts to its budget. Will the government pay to keep the tenants of Birmingham safe?
The minister said essential safety measures must be carried out.
First of all, I'd say if the city had managed its public finances better, it might be in a better position. But when it comes to essential work, of course, there should be no shortcuts. And any support that they need will be provided.
Sajid Javid insisted that because councils owned the tower blocks, it was their responsibility to decide what measures needed to be taken. But the SNP's Philippa Whitford couldn't understand why the government was making local councils responsible.
Does the secretary not recognise that escaping from a 20-floor tower block is exactly the same, whether that's in Birmingham, Manchester and London, and therefore leaving it to local decisions isn't good enough?
The former Liberal Democrat leader, Tim Farron, said it was time to look at the bigger picture.
Shouldn't the government now launch a separate formal review into the wider neglect of social housing? Because the failure to use this inquiry to examine wider neglect is an act of neglect in itself.
Labour's Ian Mearns said he represented the residents of 24 tower blocks in his Gateshead constituency.
Their buildings aren't clad the same way as Grenfell Tower, but they do live in blocks which have no sprinkler systems and many of them with single stairwells. But they have to live there, whether they're elderly, infirm, disabled or vulnerable. They're looking for peace of mind from this government, from this Secretary of State, and I'm looking for it now.
Sajid Javid said he should be reassured that all buildings were being checked and the government stood ready to give support and advice.
Mandy Baker. Sodium valproate is a valuable drug for treating epilepsy, but if a pregnant woman takes it, it can injure her unborn baby. Conditions such as cleft lip and spina bifida are around 5 times more likely. Developmental problems with growth and learning affect 30 to 40% of babies born to mothers taking the medicine. But for decades, women weren't told about the problems, and even today, it seems, many women don't know about the risks. The former health minister, the Lib Dem Norman Lamb, talked about the impact on such women.
It has had a profound impact on the mothers themselves, who too often have been treated as if they are to blame for the problems that their children face, and who then face years of guilt. And this is the really shameful aspect of this.
Norman Lamb said a Hillsborough-style panel or inquiry could be set up to investigate what he described as a continuing scandal. He added that the government had an overwhelming moral case to establish a compensation scheme for those who'd been affected by the drug. Kate Green, a Labour MP, said the issue should have been addressed a long time ago.
Would you agree that the real scandal is that we have known since the 1960s about the problems with this drug, but as the Right Honourable Gentleman says, mothers were not told, expectant women were not told, despite the fact that the government and the pharmaceutical industry knew that there were dangers?
For the SNP, Philippa Whitford, herself a surgeon, said the case raised wider questions about how patients used to be treated.
Many of us have been approached by constituents or groups in this House about several of these kind of drug scandals that in actual fact represent a very paternalistic time when the patient was not part of a team in an open discussion with the doctor. And I'm sure that there are many of these that whether it's they should be looked at together because the principles of all of them are the same.
Labour's James Frith knows about the benefits of the drug. He took it for 6 years when he was a child after meningitis left him with epilepsy.
Let me give you a sense of what it is like to endure a convulsion. There is a stillness at the control centre of your mind, but a violent movement of the body, an arm, the head, or legs. You are aware of it, but unable to prevent it or stop it.
But while he spoke for people with epilepsy, he condemned the way information had been withheld.
This is all too familiar. Another national cover-up. Further scandal from those closed decades. The we know what's best for you approach taken by the few to the many and has been said very often by men to women.
The Health Minister, Philip Dunn, said he had very great sympathy for families who'd been affected. He said when valproate was first marketed in 1974, animal studies had shown there might be a risk of birth defects. Health professionals were expected to weigh the benefits against the risks.
Campaigners and the Honourable Gentleman in his opening remarks have highlighted the minutes of a meeting of the Committee on Safety of Medicines in 1973, where the committee concluded that it would be best not to mention the risk of birth defects in package inserts. As has been referred to today, this paternalistic attitude has no place in the NHS of today.
The minister said information about the full magnitude and nature of the risks first became available in 2013. It prompted a review by the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA.
The finding of this review was that there was still a clinical need for valproate, despite the significant risks to the child if taken in pregnancy. Valproate should remain an option for women of childbearing potential only where other treatments had failed or were not tolerated. To mitigate the risks, the recommendation was that women should use effective contraception and treatment should be supervised by a specialist.
Philip Dunn said there were now warnings on packets of valproate and changes in prescribing were being tracked. He said fewer people were taking the drug, but there hadn't been what he called a step change in its use, so further action was needed. Now, for the second time this week, the Transport Secretary Chris Grayling has dismissed fears that flights between the UK and EU countries could be grounded after Brexit in March 2019. Currently, flights within the European Union operate under common aviation rules, whilst the EU as a whole has separate agreements with a number of other countries. New deals will be needed for when the UK leaves the EU. Paul Seddon has more.
Last week, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said it was theoretically conceivable that a failure to reach a Brexit deal with the EU could lead to flights being grounded. Labour's Carl Turner accused the Transport Secretary and Leave campaigner, Chris Grayling, of being in denial.
Isn't it time that the government got its finger out and gave the reassurances the aviation sector so badly needs?
Well, Mr Speaker, I'm surprised that the Honourable Gentleman, as an experienced lawyer, didn't read the whole of what the Chancellor said. Because the Chancellor said that wasn't going to happen, and therefore he wasn't going to spend a lot of money preparing for it. Now, the actual reality, Mr Speaker, is we're doing lots of preparatory work for all eventualities. But, of course, the reason the Chancellor made the point he did is because he said that wasn't going to happen.
The Transport Secretary said that although the government had a responsibility to prepare for all outcomes, he was absolutely certain that aviation would continue after the UK left the EU in 2019. Another Leave campaigner, the Conservative Sir Desmond Swain, said it was a question of economics.
What European destinations will want to turn away planeloads of spending British tourists?
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Vince Cable, said Brexit also raised questions about the way the government would deal with airports themselves. He wondered what ministers would do if the UK no longer had to apply the EU's competition rules.
How would he propose to allocate airport slots? By auctioning or in some other way?
Well, of course, the big question around the expansion of Heathrow Airport in particular in slots, that will be a matter for governments to both negotiate and agree. I happen to believe that right at the top of our priority list for the allocation of slots, something we've committed to in what we've said about the proposed expansion of Heathrow Airport, is that we reserve slots for regional connectivity.
The DUP's Jim Shannon said that as well as negotiating new agreements, there would also need to be efforts to make sure routes were not lost.
Can the Minister indicate what has been done to secure routes for the Belfast City and Belfast International Airports and to make sure that Dublin does not receive, to our detriment, the routes that we should be getting instead?
Well, of course, Mr Speaker, ultimately the choice of routes is down to the airlines themselves, though, as the Honourable Gentleman will know, we provide significant support for important links from Northern Ireland and will continue to do so.
For the SNP, Deirdre Brock wondered what the civil service outlay was to draw up new flight agreements.
Can you tell us how many staff there are in the Department of Transport with expertise of negotiating aviation deals and how many are working on deals as we speak?
Good question.
Well, I have a big team that's experienced in dealing with these things because across the world, Mr Speaker, we have bilateral arrangements with countries in all different continents.
Chris Grayling added the government had encountered nothing but goodwill in its talks with other countries.
Paul Seddon. Now, on Wednesday night, Labour won a symbolic victory over the government after MPs backed its call to put the rollout of controversial changes to the welfare system on hold. Conservatives were under orders to abstain and the result wasn't binding on ministers. But afterwards, the Commons Speaker, John Bercow, told the government it should respond to the vote on universal credit. A senior Conservative, Sir Edward Lee, agreed. He thought the Work and Pension Secretary should make a statement to MPs.
Frankly, the road to tyranny is paved by executives ignoring Parliament.
And he warned the Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, not to set a precedent.
Parliament does matter, because if we, as Conservatives, live by the sword now, our Conservative values in the future might die by the sword.
Labour's Shadow Leader of the Commons, Valerie Vaz, said the government was being disrespectful to Parliament.
There were 7 points of order following the debate yesterday, member after member. And you, Mr Speaker, want to know what the position is when the House votes 299-0. As the Shadow Secretary of State for Works and Pensions said in her point of order, if the government have retreated on certain aspects of the policy, then the Minister should come to the House and explain.
The Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, insisted ministers weren't bound by the vote.
However, what I would like to assure all members across the House is that the government is listening and has been listening.
And she highlighted the decision to stop charging people who phoned a universal credit helpline.
I can also assure colleagues that the DWP ministers will come back to this House, as they have a number of times, to update the House on progress in addressing the concerns raised from members right across this House as soon as there is more to tell the House about the achievements that have been put in place.
But the SNP's Pete Wishart said the Leader of the Commons needed to get a grip.
Well, last night went well, didn't it? What an anti-democratic shambles and utter embarrassment for this House. Just when you thought that this government couldn't show and demonstrate more contempt for the democratic arrangements of this House, they've got into that lift and taken us down another couple of levels.
MPs last debated the proposals to transfer EU law into British law after Brexit in September. And they won't be debating the EU withdrawal bill anytime soon. There was no mention of it when Andrea Leadsom announced next week's parliamentary business. Labour's Valerie Vaz wanted to know when the legislation would reappear in the Commons.
I read on an email yesterday, Mr Speaker, that it's after the November recess. Is that correct?
Andrea Leadsom said MPs had proposed 300 amendments and 50 new clauses, and she insisted there was nothing odd about a pause between the parliamentary stages of a bill.
In constitutional bills, such as the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, there were 6 sitting weeks between second reading and committee of the whole House. During the Human Rights Act of 1998, there were 10 sitting weeks between second reading and committee of the whole House.
The SNP's Pete Wishart suggested the legislation had been put on hold.
It's not all these amendments she talks about. It's because the fractious Conservative Party cannot agree a solid line on all this, and they're just terrified of any possible defeats. That's why we're not seeing it. And they're talk now that we might not even see the repeal bill much before Christmas. We have to see it soon.
Pete Wishart. Now, should pregnant women who are struggling to give up smoking be given free electronic cigarettes? It was just one of the ideas that was raised when MPs debated the government's tobacco control plan for England. Nick Qureshi reports.
In 1974, almost half the population in England lit up. Last year, that figure had fallen to around 1 in 6 people. The aim is to get the numbers down even further to 12% by 2022. Labour's Sir Kevin Barron, who's also the vice chairman of the all-party parliamentary group on smoking and health, had some worrying statistics.
Tobacco use remains the leading cause of preventable premature deaths and ill health, accounting for around 100,000 deaths each year in the UK. On top of that, all of the hospital admissions for respiratory problems in 2014-15, 23% were directly attributable to smoking.
Sir Kevin pointed to what he called a glaring lack of money for services to stop smoking. He suggested tobacco companies should pay. Another Labour MP, Paul Williams, also took manufacturers to task.
Powerful tobacco companies were placing their products in movies and using careful branding to make us think that cigarettes would make us more attractive, athletic, even smarter. What they forgot to tell us was that they also leave you unable to breathe, cause heart attacks, and kill half of the people who use them.
There were many personal stories of how smoking had killed family members. The Conservative Mims Davis lost both parents when they were in their early 70s.
Both before my 40th birthday and both before I came to this place. They've not had a chance as a result to see their grandchildren's growing, and I know this is something that many families, as a result of smoking, live and have to deal with.
The Conservative MP Will Quince co-chairs the all-party group on baby loss. He said it was vital to cut the number of pregnant smokers.
1 in 5 stillbirths are associated with smoking. Women who smoke are 27% more likely to have a miscarriage. Their risk of having a stillbirth is a third higher than non-smokers. Mothers who smoke are more likely to have preterm births, and babies who are small for their gestational age.
The tobacco plan aims to cut the number of 15-year-olds smoking from 8 to 3%. It mentions the use of e-cigarettes for the first time, something praised by Labour's Mary Glyndon.
Independent studies by Public Health England and the Royal College of Physicians recognise vaping as being at least 95% less harmful than smoking, and research by the University of St Andrews found that the cancer risk from vaping was only 1% that of smoking.
The Shadow Health Minister, Sharon Hodgson, welcomed what she called the plan's ambitious goals, but added...
We still remain concerned with how this plan will effectively be implemented and achieved, especially when it comes to the short-sighted cuts to public health budgets.
The Health Minister, Steve Bryan, said Public Health England would continue to support local authorities to develop local approaches in what he called the most cost-effective and most evidence-based way. He said there was evidence the government's approach to reducing smoking was working.
We are now considered by independent experts to have the best tobacco control measures in Europe. And we published the new plan this year to build on that success. But there's no real room, is there, in this game for patting on backs. We've got huge amounts still to do. We still have 7.3 million smokers. This exerts a huge impact on our communities and on our NHS.
Smoking is estimated to cost the NHS in England £2.5 billion a year, and the wider economy, £11 billion.
Nick Qureshi. Now, the former head of MI6, Sir John Sawyers, has said the UK could end up poorer and weaker after Brexit and would have to demonstrate a new dynamism to recover its position. He was speaking to a House of Lords committee, which is investigating the UK's influence over EU foreign and security policy after Brexit. Sir John, who campaigned for Remain in the EU referendum, said he didn't want to say anything to make the Prime Minister's job any more difficult.
If I'm honest, my Lord Chairman, my biggest concern is the economic impact that Brexit is going to have. We don't know that yet. I'm not an economist, but everything I hear from my friends in the city and in the investment world suggests that the economic impact of Brexit is going to be quite significant.
The former chief of the Secret Intelligence Service said a country's power and influence in the world was directly related to its economic performance.
In the short term, in the next 5 years or so, if I'm right that the economy is going to take a hit, then our influence will diminish in that period.
He predicted that the UK would have to find a new way of generating substantial economic growth in order to exert the level of international influence it would like. And he told the peers there were a range of outcomes.
The default outcome is that the United Kingdom is poorer and weaker as a result of Brexit. And we would have to take specific actions through the negotiations and over the years following Brexit in order to recover that position and demonstrate a new dynamism. We've done it once before. During the 1970s, this country was going down. I remember studying for my A-levels by the light of candles in 1973. And that was a pretty desperate state that the country was in. But we managed to turn that round through the 80s, 90s and 2000s.
And those comments from Sir John Sawyers bring us to the closing headline from Westminster. The government has confirmed that an investigation is underway into claims that some British banks could be unwittingly linked to a corruption scandal in South Africa. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Rachel Byrne. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.